day was the direct descendant of the senior branch of the Nguyen dynasty, and proud of it. He worshipped his venerable ancestor, Jia Long. Born in 1882, Quang Dae saw himself as the next in line to rule as the emperor who would modernize Vietnam. The French, of course, did not necessarily see it this way, and passed him over in favor of a host of seemingly more docile candidates, culminating in the crowning of Bao Dai in 1926. Anti-colonialists, however, turned to Quang Dae precisely because of the royalist legitimacy they felt he could confer on their efforts to drive out the French and remake Vietnam. In 1906, the patriot Phan Boi Chau brought the young prince to Japan to serve as the figurehead for a series of associations in exile and governments in waiting. Quang Dae, however, always marched to his own drum. He closely followed colonial and international developments from his position of exile, moving from Tokyo to Guangzhou by way of Bangkok, waiting for a favorable conjuncture to present itself. He recruited supporters from inside Vietnam and searched out new allies wherever he could. In 1913, thanks to German support and attracted by the liberal policies of the new Governor-General of Indochina, Albert Sorot, Quang Dae traveled to Berlin to let the government know that he was ready to negotiate. The French never took him or his reformist ideas seriously, and the prince never trusted the French again. He turned permanently instead to the Japanese, convinced that they would free Vietnam from its colonial hold and restore him and his rightful branch of the royal family to the throne. In the end, Quang Dae lost his bet when the Japanese failed to support him during their occupation of Indochina during the Second World War. He died in exile in Tokyo in 1951, a broken and bitterly disappointed man. But at the turn of the 20th century, he and hundreds of others looking to free their country had no way of knowing what the future would bring. Quang Dae's itinerary took him to Asia. Others traveled to the West. Some went to Moscow, while many more stayed in Vietnam. Some gambled that the French would help them to remake Vietnam. Others were convinced it would be a futile effort. Reformism and change, Asian connections, imperial alliances. East Asian reformism. The consolidation of Paul Doumer's Indochina at the turn of the century did not sever Vietnamese elites from their Asian world. Indeed, until the end of the First World War, a wide range of reform-minded mandarins turned to the surrounding region as much as to France for models of successful economic, political, and scientific modernization and information about regional and world events. At the outset, Japan was a particularly attractive model. Since the 17th century, Tokugawa rulers had relied on mainly Dutch traders to provide them with books and information on European science and thought. This school of Western studies, Rangaku, contributed to the country's takeoff when Meiji leaders assumed power in 1868. 3 decades later, fellow Asians marveled at the revolutionary transformation of Japan into a modern nation-state, with military power and economic force increasingly on par with the West. Thousands flocked to Tokyo to see for themselves, including several hundred Vietnamese. There is more to this Asian connection for these Vietnamese than the attraction of the Meiji miracle, however. Linguistically, neither the French language nor the colonial-backed Romanized script Quoc Nu could replace the elite's centuries-old use of Chinese characters overnight. Until the First World War, most Vietnamese discovered the ideas of Montesquieu and Rousseau in Chinese translation rather than in the French original. This was particularly true in Annam and Tonkin, where the Confucian-based civil service examination was longest established and relayed in Chinese characters for the greatest period of time. It was eliminated in 1919. This meant that most of the young male elite continued to study in Chinese ideograms in the hope of passing the exam and landing good jobs. Although Quoc Nu and French developed earlier in Cochinchina, It was not until the 1920s that colonial schools truly began producing a new generation of Vietnamese at ease in both. Lastly, the French created the redoubtable political police in 1917. The Sûreté Générale, determined anti-colonialists, could readily use false papers and ingenious disguises to board visiting ships bound for Hong Kong, Guangzhou, Shanghai, Tokyo, and Yokohama. Asia also continued to flow into colonial Vietnam. The French may have terminated Wei's tributary missions to Beijing, thereby ending the court's ability to import books and information directly from China, but they provided a substitute by accelerating Chinese immigration to the colony. Many of the Chinese living in Indochina and elsewhere were avid readers of new books, Hsin Shu, and sympathetic to well-known mainland reformers such as Liang Qichao and Kang Yaowei. Some of these overseas communities, Hua Qiao, traced their origins back to 17th century Ming loyalists who had fled Qing conquest in 1644. Chinese nationalists opposed to the same dynasty for 2.5 centuries later often found natural allies among these overseas Chinese communities. The father of modern China, Sun Yat-sen, traveled widely between Singapore and San Francisco, making stopovers in Saigon and Hanoi in the early 1900s. He solicited donations, enrolled young recruits, and established nationalist associations among the Chinese diaspora. Vietnamese anti-colonialist memoirs repeatedly mention Chinese traders and skippers shuttling them all over Asia well into the 1950s. This also meant that there was no shortage of Chinese language books, papers, reformist pamphlets, religious texts, and translations available in Chinese bookshops and associations in French Indochina. While few Vietnamese mandarins could actually speak Chinese, they could communicate via brush conversations and increasingly frequented Chinese bookshops in search of these new publications they could easily read. As one French official reported at the time, the majority of Chinese residents in Indochina are in sympathy with the Chinese Revolutionary Party, and it is in part by means of the journals they receive, as well as their remarks and their conversations, that they contribute to the spread of new ideas among the Annamite population. In 1910, the French were shocked to learn that mandarins in the provinces were still reading the works of Liang Qichao and Kang Yaowei, thanks to Chinese skippers carrying papers and books from one port to another, as they had done for centuries. Meeting them on the docks were trusted couriers who quickly shuttled these materials to waiting mandarins. As another worried colonial official described the last step nicely, thanks to their knowledge of characters, the literati recopy the articles which interest them. These are then put under their robes and smuggled to the most distant villages. That Chinese reformist ideas attracted Vietnamese attention is hardly surprising. Reformers in China and Vietnam confronted many of the same problems, not least the struggle against imperial aggression and the quest to unlock the keys of Western modernization. However, as noted before, a major shift occurred in this China-centered East Asian world. Thanks to its rapid modernization, free of foreign domination, Meiji Japan, 1868 to 1912, sought to replace the seemingly sick Chinese imperial giant. By the turn of the century, the Meiji Navy had not only inflicted a military defeat on the Qing over Korea and had colonized Taiwan, but Japan had also become the home to an array of organizations promoting a Japanese-centered Asia based on common cultural and racial ties. The possibility that the Chinese Empire would implode seemed likely for many. Liang Qichao, Kang Yaowei, and Sun Yat-sen traveled to Japan in the hope that Meiji would help them against the Qing and provide students with the modern knowledge and military science needed to build a new China. The Japanese defeat of the Russians in 1905, the victory of a yellow race over a white one, further shifted the center of gravity eastward, convincing many that the Europeans were not invincible and that there is an Asian way out of the social Darwinian dead end, which held that white stood for both right and might, and that it had started in Japan. In 1905, Sun Yat-sen created the Chinese Revolutionary Alliance headquarters in Tokyo, the precursor of the Chinese Nationalist Party, Kuomintang, or GMD. Liang established schools the Qing would have never authorized back home. The Japanese operated the East Asian Higher Preparatory School. One of its pupils was a certain Zhao Enlai. Meanwhile, Chiang Kai-shek studied in the Imperial Japanese Army Academy Preparatory School. Both men would become leaders of 20th century China, and each would play a part in shaping Vietnam's 20th century destiny. Vietnamese elites were part of these wider movements. This was certainly the case for the great literati Phan Boi Chau, 1867 to 1940, and Phan Chu Trinh, 1872 to 1926. Both men had been born in the heart of the Nguyen dynasty and had come of age during the violent French conquest of their country. Like their fathers, both men had diligently studied classical Chinese until their 20s and prepared tirelessly for the civil service exams. In the end, however, neither made a career in government. Each in his own way was determined to rethink a Vietnam that was no more. Disappointed by Tu Duc's failure to implement reforms, both became avid readers of new books and closely followed events in Asia and the world. Trinh would distance himself from Chau's support of armed liberation and confidence in the Japanese. He turned instead to the French to implement Western change. Like Quang De, both men gambled on their foreign allies, and each would be bitterly disappointed. But neither could know it at the time. Phan Boi Chau and the Asian Sources of Vietnamese Reformism. Freed from family obligations in 1900 by the death of his father, Phan Boi Chau went to work immediately. Traveling tirelessly from north to south, he discussed what was to be done with like-minded friends, veterans of the Can Vuong movement, reformist mandarins, and patriotic youths who had flocked around him. In 1904, he united supporters into a study group called the Vietnamese Modernization Society, Viet Nam Doi Tan Hoi. Unsurprisingly, Chinese reformist texts were high on everyone's reading list. Royalists were welcome, too. Chau's prestige was such that he easily recruited the Nguyen prince, Quang De, to the society and made him honorary president in order to attract the widest possible support. While the Vietnamese Modernization Society never went very far ideologically, it was more forward-looking than the restoration-minded Can Vuong movement led by Phan Dinh Phung. Exchanges focused on the need to implement wide-ranging socio-economic reforms. It differed, too, in that the new group's leaders were determined to send students abroad. Chau initially placed great hope in Japanese promises of uniting East Asian peoples of the same culture and common race into a liberating and modernizing force. In late 1904, the Modernization Society dispatched him to Japan on a fact-finding mission. Chau landed in Yokohama in early 1905 as the Russo-Japanese War reached its climax. He quickly befriended Liang Qichao and, thanks to an indefatigable writing brush, explained the sad plight of the Vietnamese people and his group's desire to obtain Japanese assistance to expel the French and modernize the country. Well aware of Japan's imperial ambitions, Liang warned his counterpart of the dangers of relying too heavily on the Japanese and their pan-Asianism. He advised Chau to focus first on reform, on educating the young, and awakening the patriotism of the people. "Your country should not be concerned about not having a day of independence," he counseled, "but should be concerned about not having an independence-minded people." Liang knew what he was talking about. China was in much the same situation. He was himself bringing students to study in Japanese schools and military academies. Liang's warnings about Meiji's expansionist ambitions did not deter Chao from soliciting military aid. Chao contacted a wide range of Japanese politicians, diplomats, officers, and intellectuals. This included the future Japanese Prime Minister Inukai Tsuyoshi, Okuma Shigenobu, who was to be Prime Minister twice, and General Fukushima Yasumasa, director of the Shimbu Military Academy. All of these meetings in 1905 occurred against the backdrop of Japan's victory over the Russians and Tokyo's entry into the Western-centered concert of nations. In his meeting with Shigenobu, Chao lauded Japan's emergence as a world power, but reminded him of Tokyo's Asian responsibilities. Vietnam is not on the European continent, but on the Asian one. Vietnam is common to Japan in race, culture, and continental positioning, yet the French gangsters are left to spread their bestial venom without fear. Hence, the French are unaware that Asia already has a major power, already has Japan. The strength of Japan has been felt in the Northwest, all the way to the Qing and to the Russians. Why then has Japan allowed the French to trample over Vietnam without trying to help us? The Japanese had no intention of moving militarily against the French over Indochina, not in 1905 in any case. They were focused instead on rolling back the Chinese imperial hold in East Asia and consolidating their own colonial gains in Taiwan, Korea, and Manchuria. Improving diplomatic relations with the West helped them do that. Fanboy Chao could send students to study with them, but no more. It was in this wider Asian context that the Go East, Dongdu, study abroad program began sending Vietnamese students to Japan. Chao wrote letters and tracts urging families to send their sons. Back in Vietnam, he knocked on doors and found considerable support among reform-minded mandarins in Annam and Tonkin, so much so that in 1907, Governor General Paul Bo conceded privately that those traveling to Japan were mainly the sons of mandarins keen on learning. Yet the Go East movement was not just an Annam and Tonkin affair. Wealthy landowners and pro-Nguyen royalists in Cochin China also provided financial support and recruits. Gilbert Tran Chan Chu was a well-known Mekong landowner, entrepreneur, and naturalized French citizen. He encouraged Southern youth, including his son, to study in Japan. Chu personally traveled to Hong Kong in 1907 to discuss ways of modernizing the country and funding study abroad. Meanwhile, to attract students, Prince Quang De drew upon latent royalist sympathies among Southern families that had supported his grandfather's victory of 1802. In all, between 1906 and 1909, around 300 Vietnamese studied in Japanese schools and military academies. For the first time since the late 1850s, Viet elites from all three areas of former Dai Nam met to study and rethink their country, not in Paris, but in Tokyo. Indeed, more Vietnamese were studying abroad in Japan than in France at this time. Time in exile also allowed older men like Phan Boi Chau to rethink Vietnam without fear of arrest or censorship. Besides taking care of students and getting Prince Quang De to Japan, one of the most important things Chao did was to write texts to awaken the people. Taking Liang's advice to heart, he put pen to paper to provide some of the foundational texts of modern Vietnamese nationalism. This meant closely reading Japanese, Chinese, and Western materials in search of models, styles, and comparisons. Tokyo libraries and bookshops and his numerous encounters in East Asia provided him with a goldmine of information. One of the most important things he realized was that in order to explain the sad state of his country in the present and imagine a new future, he had to return to, indeed, rethink the past. The result was the publication in 1905 of The History of the Loss of Vietnam. In it, Chao lambasted the Nguyen for losing the country and failing to implement reforms in time. He celebrated the Kanvuang heroes who had resisted valiantly and condemned those who had collaborated. He focused on the evils of French colonialism, detailing the terrible effects of Dumer's tax and labor demands on the common people. To communicate his awakening message more effectively, Chow dropped much of the flowery style and arcane allusions of the Confucian tradition to write in direct, hard-hitting prose. Although he was still writing in characters, he and others realized that in order to communicate their message to a wider audience, they had to recalibrate their prose and their own ways of thinking. In the last section, Chow turned to his future Vietnam, insisting that all of the people had to join hands to save the country, regardless of class, religion, or race. Liang Qichao published the book and distributed copies among the overseas Chinese. In fact, Chow's history of Vietnam ended up stirring Chinese patriots as much as Vietnamese ones. Sun Yat-sen was so alarmed by what he read that he warned his compatriots in southern China to beware of the dangers that could befall them as Dumer laid train tracks for Kunming. Chow took 50 copies of his book home, where they were recopied, increasingly translated into Quoc Nu, always circulated clandestinely, and sometimes read out loud to interested villagers. In short, Phan Boi Chow's exile in Japan allowed him to rethink Vietnamese history in increasingly national forms. In his Letter from Abroad, written in blood, he focused again on the evils of French colonialism and urged his readers to wake up before it was too late. He criticized the monarchy and the Mandarinate for failing to save the country and to help the people in their hour of greatest need. He argued that a new type of community was in order, a national one, by which the pre-existing bond between emperor and subject would be replaced by one associating the people with the nation. It was at this point that Chow and others began to use new Atlantic revolutionary terms to communicate ideas based on Meiji models and Japanese loan words, such as revolution, kachmeng, nation, kwak ya, and citizen, Dan Quoc. Why was our country lost? He asked rhetorically. First, the monarch knew nothing of popular affairs. Second, the mandarins cared nothing for the people. And third, the people knew only of themselves. And yet the people had built the foundations of our country. The conclusion was obvious. The people are, in fact, the country. The country is the people's. He repeated the same mantra in another national history of Vietnam and undoubtedly in hundreds of conversations. He also reminded readers that the Viet had themselves once been great colonizers, the conquerors of Champa. Now, he lamented, the tables had been turned. They were the colonized, who could disappear as the Cham had under Vietnamese rule. In the end, the Go East and Vietnam Modernization Society movements were short-lived. In 1907, the French and the Japanese concluded a treaty by which Tokyo recognized French sovereignty over Indochina in exchange for France's recognition of Japan's imperial interests further north. The outbreak of tax revolts less than a year later led the French to increase pressure on Tokyo to expel the Vietnamese, and the Japanese complied. In March 1909, Phan Boi Chow left Japan to regroup among a group of overseas Vietnamese based in Thailand. A year later, the Japanese transformed Korea into a colony. Bitterly disappointed, Chow understood that Japan was as colonial-minded as the Western powers and would be of no further help. However, by providing Vietnamese emigres with a safe haven to reside, to access new information, and to study, write, and interact with a range of Asian reformers, the Japanese had contributed to the Modernization Society's ability to rethink the past, make better sense of the tumultuous present, and start to imagine a new future. This vision of a future Vietnam only existed in the imagination at that point, and it meant different things to different people. It was nonetheless an important turning point in the making of modern Vietnam. A colonial Jacuzza, Phan Chu Trinh and a Republican contract. Phan Chu Trinh was as fascinated by Japan as was Phan Boi Chau. In 1906, the two toured Tokyo together, meeting with Japanese officials and urging young Vietnamese to study hard. Each agreed that the introduction of Western-style education a la Meiji was indispensable to the country's renaissance. Both enthusiastically cited Fukuzawa Yukichi's educational reforms as a model to emulate. Beyond the quest for modernity, however, the two Phans differed greatly in their approaches. Trinh did not share his counterpart's desire to seek Japanese military assistance. He recoiled at Chow's increasing talk of achieving national liberation through violent means, and he saw little need to work with royalty like Quang De. Trinh chose instead to cooperate with the French to remake Vietnam. Besides his differences with Chow, Trinh had other reasons for making this choice. He saw in a colonial alliance the best way to achieve the reforms the Nguyen had botched in the 19th century. By conquering Da Nam, Trinh reasoned, the French had changed power relations to the detriment of the monarchy, not necessarily a bad thing, since he considered the throne to be the single greatest obstacle to change. Moreover, France seemed to offer a model for reform as promising as the Japanese one. Like their Meiji counterparts, French republicans were equally determined to create a new France, a modern nation-state, complete with a mass education system, national military service, and an infrastructure capable of turning peasants into Frenchmen. And where Chow found inspiration in Japanese-centered Pan-Asianism, Trinh was enthralled by French-championed republicanism, the universal rights of man, the idea of representative government, and welcomed the Mission Civilisatrice, which promised to extend such progress to the Republic's empire. Lastly, unlike Meiji's resurrection of its long dormant monarchy, the French had done away with their monarchy in favor of a constitutional democracy. Phan Chu Trinh's republicanism owed a great deal to two young French friends and dedicated republicans in Hanoi, the journalist Ernest Babu and the captain Jules Roux. Both were members of the Hanoi branch of the League of Human Rights, Ligue des Droits de l'Homme, established in 1903. Roux spoke Vietnamese well and advocated the development of Quốc ngữ and modern education in Indochina. In 1905, Babu launched the first Quốc ngữ newspaper in Hanoi, the Dai Viet Tam Bao, modern Dai Viet Times, in which Trinh's earliest writings appeared. Babu was also a member of the French Socialist Party and a Freemason. Phan Chu Trinh later became one. While the League of Human Rights, Freemasons, and Socialists hardly embraced decolonization, they advocated colonial reform and representative politics and firmly believed in France's Mission Civilisatrice. Phan Chu Trinh also sought to use this conjuncture and the colonizers to reform on his terms. This included his well-known goals of introducing Western studies, a mass educational system, instruction in French and Quốc ngữ, industry and commerce, and representative forms of government. However, Trinh wanted more than just a colonial Meiji. Though he could never say it publicly, he wanted to use the French to help him accomplish a colonial revolution, the overturning of the monarchy. It is unclear where Trinh's visceral hate of the monarchy originated, but it was real. In his memoirs, Phan Boi Chau wrote that during their travels together in East Asia in 1906, they argued repeatedly over which came first, relying on the French to reform Vietnam or driving them out of it. For Trinh, the emperor had to go, and if the French could help on that score, then the choice was clear. As Chow recalled later, he and I kept company in Quang Tung, Guangdong, for more than 10 days. Every day when we talked about the affairs of our country, he signaled out for bitter reproach the wicked conduct of the monarchs, the enemies of the people. He ground his teeth when talking about the ruler of the day, who is bringing calamity to the country and disaster to the people, as much as to say that if the system of monarchical autocracy were not abolished, simply restoring the country's independence would bring no happiness. In place of the monarchy, Chow wrote, Trin argued in favor of republicanism. Once popular rights have been achieved, then we can think about other things. Trin's collaboration with the French thus turned on his desire to use the French to push a very Vietnamese revolution, the overthrow of the monarchy, and the creation of a colonial republic. Rather than trying to wake up Chow's trustworthy mandarins or locate the nation in the past, Trin realized that the only way his plan would ever work was by stirring the republican conscience of his colonial rulers. This meant painting the autocratic mandarinate in the worst possible light, deploring everyday French brutalities against the Vietnamese, and then holding the highest authorities to the implementation of an indigenous policy based on their republican ideals. This is exactly what Trin did in early 1907, when the scholarly journal, the Bulletin de l'École François d'Extrême-Orient, ran his open letter to the Governor-General of Indochina, Paul Bo, 1902-8. In this historic document, Trin explained to Bo that he had traveled the country from north to south, and what he saw was heart-wrenching, the regression of the Vietnamese into a state of barbarity and their near racial extinction. He had no choice, he explained, but to inform authorities of the terrible suffering of the people and the need for immediate and real reform on their part. For Trin, the corrupt and despotic Mandarin class ruling the countryside with impunity was at the core of this suffering. By disemboweling the monarchy but leaving it in place, the French had effectively removed any sort of institutional control over these parasites. They were now free to enrich themselves and exploit the population. Theoretically, he agreed, the protectorate had dispatched French delegates to keep them in line. In practice, however, these immoral beings did whatever they pleased. Ignorant of the Vietnamese language, customs, and village politics, French commissioners were either unaware or unwilling to intervene as long as the taxes and corvée arrived on time. They needed these bad mandarins. Secondly, Trin continued, French insensitivity and brutality toward the overworked peasants, including the beating of many to death, hardly reflected well on lofty republican ideals and colonial humanism. Verbal insults and daily acts of violence against the indigenous were legion, he said, and they were. Peasants ran for cover when they saw Frenchmen coming, he pointed out. And it wasn't just the European settlers who were to blame. Haughty colonial officials often humiliated good mandarins and, in so doing, dissuaded them from reporting abuses or suggesting solutions. Meanwhile, the corrupt ones continued to ingratiate themselves, always bearing good news to the colonizers. The situation in the countryside was, Trin concluded, dire. And by entrusting these corrupt bureaucrats with collecting onerous taxes and corvée, the French were responsible for the hate and suffering piling up across the land. This was strong language. No Vietnamese elite had ever dared to address the colonizer in such terms. And yet Trin wrote to Bo because he had no other means to make himself or his people heard. There was no colonial parliament. The press remained in its infancy and heavily censored. He also made his move at this time because he knew that the Governor-General was involved in developing colonial reforms based on the principle of association. This was not the word Trin wanted to hear, for indirect rule would leave his hated mandarins in power. And you still want to increase the power of these men by confiding to them the realization of the reforms for which our salvation depends. Don't you understand they will never apply them except to make money? A former literati himself, Trin knew perfectly well that not all mandarins were bad, nor were they as anti-modern as he had portrayed them in his missive to Bo. But his goal in crafting this letter was not to present an objective study of the mandarinate or rural conditions. He wanted, above all, to jolt the French into action by convincing the Republican governor-general that his emerging native policy, politique indigène, had to extend basic human rights to the colonized and deal with the problem of a corrupt monarchy. Much like Farhat Abbas in Algeria, who denied the reality of Algerian nationalism in favor of egalitarian republican assimilation, Trinh believed that a similar colonial contract could work in Vietnam, but only if the French made good on their own republicanism. Then, he concluded, the only thing the enemies would fear would be seeing the French leave Annam to its own devices. It was an extraordinary gamble designed in large part to bring down the pre-existing Vietnamese monarchy. Like Chow's pan-Asianism, Trinh's local alliance with the French was riddled with contradictions and not a little naivete. But then again, collaboration was as important as anti-colonialism in the making of modern Vietnam, and colonial collaboration often carried within it revolutionary indigenous projects. Mandarin reformism and colonial fear. The two Fans were not alone in their quest for change, and all Mandarins were not corrupt, conservative, or anti-modern. Nor were the French or the Japanese the first to introduce notions of modernity or reform to Vietnamese elites. A large number of officials working for the Nguyen dynasty on the inside had long been interested in good government, reform, and modernization. The 15th to 16th century Lay dynasty is a case in point. And as harsh as they often were, Minh Mang's reforms had sought to rationalize and modernize Vietnam. In the late 1860s, the Catholic advisor to Emperor Tu Duc, Nguyen Trong Tho, pleaded for far-reaching economic, social, and even political reforms along Western lines. These including sending students abroad for Western studies, expanding the education system, revamping financial, judicial, and administrative institutions, developing modern science, agriculture, and commerce, and even creating a national writing system based on Chu Nam. Have we not talented persons able to devise a script which will transcribe our national language? He asked. Nguyen Trong Tho failed to convince the last emperor of the need to reform, but that does not mean that reformist debates within the Mandarinate necessarily disappeared under French rule. Another of Tu Duc's reform-minded advisers, Dang Xuan Bang, kept making the case for change. By the early 1900s, he and others had begun establishing private schools and organizing informal seminars in their spare time to teach modern ideas and practices to young and old. Classes offered instruction in French, Chinese, and Quoc Nu, as well as in mathematics, physics, and geography. These officials had access to Western and Asian reformist writings in Chinese translation, some of which appeared in the civil service exams in Wei. Other Mandarins received authorization from colonial authorities to study abroad in France. The French created the Colonial Academy in Paris in the late 19th century to train Indochinese elites in modern ways. That the future Ho Chi Minh applied, unsuccessfully, to study there is hardly surprising. And although colonial exhibitions in France in 1907, 1922, 1930-31 certainly pushed a political and orientalist agenda, they also allowed a range of elite Vietnamese to go west to study European ways, procure information, and make new contacts. Vietnamese reformism at the turn of the century thus encompassed a wide range of sources, choices, ideas, models, and people. There were never two one-way roads leading straight to modern Vietnam, one Asian Phan Boi Chau, Dong Du, the other Western Phan Chu Trinh, Di Te. Rather, different trajectories intersected, recalibrated, and shifted over time and space. Some had already developed inside Vietnam before the French had arrived, others connected to the outside world, whether the French liked it or not. Nowhere is this more evident than in the creation in early 1907 of the Tonkin Public School, the Don Kinh Nhia Tuc. In fact, 20th century Vietnam's first modern school was neither a colonial nor an anti-colonialist creation. The Tu Fans did not make it, nor did the French. This Western Studies school was a northern-based Mandarin initiative modeled on Fukuzawa Yukichi's educational policies mentioned before. The term Nia Thuc is the Vietnamese translation of the Japanese term Keio Gijuku, which refers to a non-fee-paying private school established and paid for from public donations. Knowledge of it came from Go East travelers to Japan and reformist writings circulating in Chinese, but it drew, too, upon a centuries-old Sino-Vietnamese tradition of creating private schools for teaching classical studies. Within months, this school attracted some 400 students, young and old alike. The dapper French-trained civil servant and interpreter, Nguyen Van Vinh, was there in full Western attire, as were local Mandarins supporting their Confucian garb, but nonetheless keenly aware of what was at stake. Uniting them all was a burning desire to learn and discuss new ideas and necessary reforms. Dongkin classrooms offered conferences on and instruction in mathematics, geography, and science, a particularly hot subject. Students studied French and Quoc Nu. Most, not all, agreed that Chinese characters no longer sufficed. Reformists building this school wanted a written language designed less to associate the elite with an East Asian civilizational sphere operating in characters than to educate and associate the masses inside the country with new forms of social organization via the spoken language they all shared. The Romanized script increasingly appeared as a powerful tool of modernization and socialization. As one Dongkin slogan read, "Quoc Nu is the saving spirit in our country. We must take it out among our people." More literati also began to study French. History lectures attracted large gatherings as speakers sought to distance the Vietnamese past from its civilizational association with China in favor of crafting a distinct history, a unique set of heroes, indeed, a separate cultural identity. Phan Boi Chau's writings from abroad circulated in Nia Thuc circles, while Phan Chu Trinh was a popular guest speaker. And there is no reason not to think that Chau drew many of his nationalist ideas from texts being produced inside Vietnam. As elsewhere in Asia, much effort went into promoting social and cultural change along Western lines. This is evident in the titles of many of the texts the Nia Thuc produced, such as Civilization and New Learning or The Indictment of Corrupt Customs. The former called upon young Vietnamese to break with the Confucian past and embrace the modern world. Several teachers argued that the East had become stagnant, while the West was now the most dynamic part of the world. And it wasn't long before many began to see Confucianism as an obstacle to the modernization and Westernization of the country. In another major shift, women entered the classrooms for the first time as traditional social relations loosened. Change even manifested itself corporally as part of the haircutting chant shows recited by Nia Thuc adepts. Comb in the left hand, scissors in the right, snip, snip, clip, clip. Watch out, be careful, drop stupid practices, dump childish things, speak openly and frankly, study Western customs, don't cheat or bluff, don't lie. Today we clip, tomorrow we shave. However, this early attempt at modern education and socio-cultural change on Vietnamese terms did not last long. When a revolt broke out in February 1908 against excessive corvée demands, just as Phan Chu Trinh had warned, the French did the only thing they knew how to do. They cracked down violently as it spread. The discovery of a plot to poison French troops a few months later only led to more repression as scared European settlers demanded swift and decisive action. Rather than reflecting on the socio-economic causes of this discontent and devising appropriate policy measures, fear got the better of the French, and not just among the small settler community. A special criminal commission set up on Paul Bo's watch sentenced 13 Vietnamese plotters to death, and many more to long prison terms. Phan Chu Trinh, the Third Republic's most sincere indigenous collaborator, was soon breaking rocks on the prison island of Po Lu Condor. Vietnam's dedicated Republican remained in the colonial Bastille until 1911, when the French shipped him off to France. Colonial authorities quickly closed the Nia Tuc school for good. The imperial trajectories of Vietnamese reformism, exile, and labor. Phan Chu Trinh was not the only person the French wanted to get out of Indochina. Early on, the French dispatched tens of thousands of Vietnamese laborers to work on commercial plantations, mines, and in colonial offices in New Caledonia, New Hebrides, Polynesia, and Reunion Island. Others followed imperial itineraries, taking them to French North Africa and South America. Moving in parallel to these workers were several thousand Vietnamese political prisoners, whom the French banished to colonial prisons and penal colonies as far away as Guyana and Guadeloupe. The French exiled their rebellious emperors, most notably Ham Nhi, Than Thai, and Duy Than, to Algeria and Reunion Island, while promising elite members, mandarins, and wealthy students pursued advanced studies in the metropolis. These imperial-wide movements gave rise to some interesting encounters. First stationed in Algeria at the turn of the 20th century as an agricultural specialist trained in France, the future constitutionalist Bùi Quang Chu met the deposed emperor, Ham Nhi, in Algiers and maintained a long correspondence with him on how best to modernize Vietnam. Kỳ Dong, a brilliant Vietnamese young man who was undertaking his secondary studies in Algiers, also befriended Ham Nhi when he was there. Kỳ Dong's return to Vietnam in 1896 did not last long, however. When the French connected him to anti-colonialist rebels, they exiled him to Polynesia, where he took up art and became a good friend to the artist Paul Gauguin. Many of these exiles were transformed by their experience and returned home to play a role in the making of a new Vietnam in 1945. This was the case for Dong Si Hua, a colonial plantation worker in the French Pacific who joined the resistance. Another exiled emperor, Duy Than, died in a plane crash in 1945 in Central Africa, trying to make it home to reclaim his throne. Ex-political prisoners from Guyana returned in 1963, as did 50,000 Vietnamese from northeast Thailand. A small maritime and increasingly politicized Vietnamese working class also emerged as French and international shipping companies employed more and more sailors, deckhands, cooks, and laundry boys to handle the goods and passengers crossing the Indian Ocean. The merchant shipping company, Compagnie de Messagerie Maritime, and the United Shipping Company, Compagnie de Chargeurs Réunis, probably employed annually 1,000 Vietnamese sailors who sailed the world from Saigon to Shanghai, Osaka to Singapore, and then on to the Atlantic through Djibouti, Aden, and the Suez Canal. Cochin Chinese, Annamese, and especially Tonkinese worked on the ship's decks together. They also joined hands with Chinese workers. Not all of them became revolutionaries. Most worked to feed themselves and their families. But a handful encountered new ideas, people, and associations, including notions of organized labor, as they moved from one port city to another. It was a motley crew, to be sure, but it was where revolutionaries like Phan Boi Chau and Ho Chi Minh would go to gather information, avoid police detection, and think about Vietnam in different ways. A future communist leader, Thanh Duc Thanh, came from this maritime working class. A Trotskyist debarking in Marseille in the 1920s left a lively description of the men who helped him make all the right connections. He was most impressed by a certain Han, a colonial sailor turned drug trafficker who was running opium from one side of the Mediterranean to the other. Han is cunning at getting things in under the noses of customs officials. The First World War globalized imperial movements and demands for political reforms in unprecedented ways. Although the French were at first reluctant to bring any Vietnamese soldiers to the metropolis in the light of repeated revolts and defiant emperors, the intensification and entrenchment of the conflict left them no choice. They badly needed men to help supply and fight on the Western Front, as well as to work in munitions factories to provide the massive amounts of weapons this industrial conflagration required: artillery shells, guns, bullets, and uniforms. In all, the French recruited and dispatched 90,000 Vietnamese to France, where 50,000 worked in local factories and the other 40,000 proceeded to the front. Many served in combat positions. The Vietnamese were part of a larger mobilization bringing almost 1 million colonial subjects to France, including British subjects from India. Joining them, too, were tens of thousands of workers from Spain, Italy, and especially China. This gave rise to a fascinating wartime situation in which non-French male workers joined a very feminized French workforce on the factory floors. Although French authorities carefully organized and disciplined the workplace in order to meet wartime needs, fraternization and even mixed unions emerged from this multi-ethnic labor mobilization. Racist attitudes of hostility toward foreigners, and above all, fears of colonial men mixing with French women while Frenchmen fought at the front, were real. So were class fears in French unions like the CGT that this colonial labor force would take working-class jobs. But there was no denying the transformative impact of this wartime mobilization, as almost 100,000 Vietnamese veterans returned to Indochina hoping to start a new life. Some wanted French citizenship, most expected good jobs and upward social mobility. Several hoped to modernize Vietnam along Western lines, despite the barbarity they had just witnessed in Europe. Most Vietnamese reformists supported the war effort in the hope that the colonizers would now have to make good on their promises of political and social reform. They had a debt to pay. Cultural luminaries like Nguyen Van Vinh, Duong Van Giao, and Phan Van Trong dusted off their initial training as interpreters and served as intermediaries for administering the Vietnamese troops and laborers in France. Phan Chu Trinh lent his personal support to colonial efforts to recruit Vietnamese men for the war effort, and this despite the fact that the French had thrown him in jail in September 1914 for 6 months on trumped-up charges of colluding with Prince Quang Đệ and the Germans. Vietnamese administrators, some of them sharing Trinh's reformist dreams, but most acting on French orders, mobilized the local administration and the protectorates of Annam and Tonkin to provide the majority of recruits the French needed in record time. Vietnamese elite members like Phan Chu Trinh were also aware of a parallel reformist trend that had developed at the highest levels of the French army in the person of General Théophile Pénicaud. Having served throughout the empire and with such well-known colonial conquerors as Liu Te, Gallieni, and Pavi, Pénicaud rose to the top of the army and head of colonial troops in Indochina in 1911. A devout republican, he was also a man born in the 1840s, who could have served in one of Napoleon III's Arab offices in Algeria, such was his belief in association and the respect of local cultures. He was also a fine observer of colonial policies in other empires, notably that of the Americans in the Philippines. He worried that trouble in China could spill into Indochina, and if the French did not give more of a voice to Vietnamese elite members in actually running the colony, including the army, then they should not count on them to help keep Indochina French in times of trouble. Close to Jules Roux, himself a friend of Phan Chu Trinh, Pénicaud had followed Vietnamese reformism and witnessed the violent revolts that had ended in so many executions in 1908 and Trinh's exile. He cringed at the French settler disdain for the Vietnamese. Whereas his counterpart, General Charles Magnan, advocated a force noire, Black Army, using mainly Senegalese troops to help France fight in the event of war, Pendekan asked for the creation of a mainly Vietnamese Armée Jaune, Yellow Army. Not only would it defend Indochina and France in times of need, but it would also promote some Vietnamese to positions of command and provide the French with loyal partners with whom they could build a new and, eventually, independent Indochinese state. The general's ideas enthralled Vietnamese reformers. Trinh threw his full support behind the general at the same time as the French settler community vehemently denounced him for arming the barbarians from the inside. The French government would study Pénicaud's plans. But when the First World War broke out, the leadership in Paris and Hanoi insisted that the Vietnamese had not evolved sufficiently to adopt Pénicaud's project. Rather than sending the Armée Jaune to fight on the Western Front, the French preferred sending the bulk of Vietnamese as factory workers and logistical supply hands. It is hard to underestimate the significance of the Great War for Vietnamese reformists. In exchange for their defense of France, Vietnamese of all political colors expected the French to make good on their promises of change. It is no accident that Duong Van Giao's remarkable history of the Indochinese during the First World War called on the French to adopt a new native policy. This is precisely what the authors of the Revendication du Peuple Annamite, Phan Chu Trinh, Phan Van Trong, and Ho Chi Minh, requested in 1919, not independence, but republican reformism. But instead of sending Pénicaud to Hanoi to build a new Indochinese state in collaboration with reformist members of the elite and thousands of returning veterans, the French sent Albert Soreau. His answer to the Revendication was a policy of enlightened Franco-Vietnamese collaboration and colonial monarchy. Soreau and the Making of an Indochinese State. The Policy of Franco-Vietnamese Collaboration. As Pénicaud's Armée Jaune project shows, the French were no more monolithic in their reformist thinking and state-building plans than the Vietnamese. Nor did colonial policy in Indochina operate independently of the center, other parts of the empire, or without connection to neighboring colonial states. Caught off guard by the revolts of 1908 and troubled by the heavy-handed repression used to stop them, a remarkable debate ensued among metropolitan leaders. For the first time, important parliamentarians and colonial policymakers realized that it was not enough to conquer, exploit, and punish. Paul Bert and Paul Doumer may have created a more centralized administration and extricated the revenue and labor needed to do so, but it had come at a great cost for the colonized. 4 decades after the admirals had first landed in Cochin China, the events of 1908 made it clear to many in Paris that the French colonial presence in Indochina still lacked legitimacy among peasants and elite alike. Why did metropolitan leaders take particular notice of events in Indochina at this time? Ideology was one reason. The Dreyfus Affair, 1894 to 1906, and the rise of French socialism under Jean Jaurès were energizing republicanism, as was the advent of a modern activist press in the Third Republic. Disgusted by the repressive measures used in 1908, the socialist Francis de Pressensy and vice president of the newly created League of Human Rights in France, 1898, asked how the Republic could use extrajudicial means in Indochina to execute Vietnamese and still remain true to its principles at home. Though the Vietnamese were colonial subjects, they were humans too, he and others insisted. Like-minded deputies deplored a long list of colonial abuses. Maurice Violette, a Freemason and colonial reformer, stated that the French could not claim to be a superior race by committing rape, murder, and battery in Indochina. Deputies also criticized onerous taxation, oppressive monopolies, and excessive labor coercion as unworthy of the Republic. In a series